Hi everyone, I'm Stephen Downs. Welcome to another edition of Ethics, Analytics, and the Duty of Care. Today we're going to be looking at the study of meta-ethics, or as my old professor used to say, meta-ethics. What meta-ethics are is the study of ethical reasoning itself, questioning where our ethical theories come from, and how we evaluate them and how we apply them. I'm going to set this up by putting this into a bit of context and by posing a question. And the question is, does might make right? Well, Wikipedia says might makes right or might is right is an aphorism both on the origin of morality with both prescriptive, let's try that again. Might makes right, or might is right, is an aphorism on the origin of morality with both descriptive and prescriptive senses. And it's of course the idea that, ethics is whatever the strongest person in the room says it is. Or, the biggest bully on the block, or the most powerful nation in the global community. And it's enough to make you a bit skeptical about the concept of ethics generally, isn't it? Because the idea of might making right kind of removes the whole aspect of moral reasoning and thinking about morality entirely. And in fact, and I'm horribly paraphrasing Max Weber here, and so forgive me, those of you who have studied his work, but we could say something like, the study of morality really is the study of power. That ultimately is what ethics gets down to. We don't want to lose sight of that fact, and I'm going to call it a fact because I think that we can't really ignore that aspect of ethics when we're talking about ethics. Of course, the modern equivalent is the new golden rule, and the new golden rule is this: whoever has the gold makes the rules. And again, it's another sort of power ethic position, right? And here the might isn't expressed in terms of force or military power, but rather in the persuasive capacity of a lot of money. And we see from the cartoon there on the slide, some people who belong to the 99% who've been laid off, who are losing their homes, etc. The politician who's getting their 99% of their campaign dollars from the top 1%, which is the reason, says the third person or the fourth person, why the 99% have zero chance. You might think it's kind of a cynical approach to ethics. I kind of do. But at the same time, we actually see this instantiated pretty much on an everyday basis, baldly and in front of us. You've probably heard the expression, voting with your dollars, and things like boycotts or selective purchasing or even consumer activism as a way to make a point, generally an ethical point, but all that does is to concede that whoever has the most dollars here is going to get the most votes. And in fact, with the 1% having most of the money, not just more than everyone else, but most of the money, that leaves the rest of us effectively without a vote. So, there's a reality to the new golden rule. Well, is that the case? Should that be the case? There are different ways we can approach ethics when confronted with the reality of ethics as it exists in the world. I'm going to describe three of them here, which I've taken from a web page. But, you know, we could probably come up with a few more. But it gives you a sense of the range of thinking that's possible. So one type of ethic is descriptive ethics. Quoting from the Learn Religions webpage, people tend to make decisions which bring pleasure and avoid pain. That's an example of descriptive ethics. What it's doing is it's taking a look at the world and describing what ethics actually are as seen in the actions of people in the world. So when we express a principle like the new golden rule, whoever has the gold makes the rules, we could be describing the actual ethical state of affairs in the world. But that doesn't end the discussion. There's also normative ethics. And by normative, we don't mean something that is normal. What we mean is something that establishes what should be a norm. So the example here from the same source, the moral decision is that which enhances well-being and limits suffering. Now, if we go out there in the world, we'll see a lot of people making decisions that they call ethical that don't address these at all. But what we're saying here is that what they should be basing their ethics on is well-being and limit suffering. Okay. And then there's a third kind of ethics, which we could call analytic ethics. And it's more about understanding what the meaning of ethical talk is about and breaking down, you know, if we express an ethical principle, what does that mean? How does that cash out in terms of actual practice, etc.? So the example here is morality is simply a system for helping humans stay happy and alive. So we're not talking about the truth or falsity of it. We're not saying we should or shouldn't, but we're breaking down what these statements are and expressing what they are in terms of meaning. So again, these three don't eliminate all possible types of ethics. We could probably come up with a few more types of ethics. But they give you a sense that when we start talking ethics, it's not all going to be the same thing. So let's break that down more. The study of meta-ethics, and I've combined it into one word in the title, but a lot of the time you'll see it with a hyphen just to make the two words clearer, is essentially the study of what grounds an ethical argument. We're going to come back to the precise wording of that in a little bit. And, you know, I mean, and we look at where we are in the context of the current inquiry, looking at all the uses of learning analytics and looking at the ethical issues that have been raised, all of the ethical codes that we've looked at, the ethical theories that may ground those codes, although we don't really have a good mapping yet, and that's an exercise we could and probably should undertake, assuming it's even possible, and I'm not sure that it is. But then we need to turn around and ask, what is the basis or the fundamental ground for one approach or another? You know, because we need to choose between utilitarianism or deontic ethics or social contract model of some sort. And on what basis do we make those choices? I mean, it's not like we're just going to put, you know, some paper slips in a hat and pick one out. Oh, yeah, that one. No, we need to have some basis for making these decisions. There isn't just one ethics that we can say, yeah, this is it. You know, after all of our study, we've solved it. There are many different approaches and many different flavors. And if nothing else in this module, you should have seen that. So, okay, let's look at some of these breakdowns then. So, one flavor of ethics can be called cognitivist ethics, based on the principle of cognitivism. Now, in this context, cognitivism is, and I'm quoting here, the idea that moral statements have the capability of being objectively true or false, since they are descriptive of some external reality in the world. Now, sorry about the typo on the slide there. So, there's two things that are happening here. The first thing, three things actually, if we think about it. First of all, we have moral statements, propositions, if you will. Like, for example, killing people is wrong. And these propositions are semantical in nature. What I mean by that is, as the outline says, they have the capacity of being true or false. In other words, we could say it is true that killing people is wrong, or we could say it is false that killing people is wrong. And we'll have the usual train come by. But the third thing about cognitivism is that the truth or falsity of these statements is established in some way. Now, they've glossed over a huge area of epistemology by saying descriptive of some external reality in the world. For the semantics to actually apply, we need to say that they correspond to some external reality in the world, or are consistent with descriptions of the external reality in the world, or something like that. They refer to some external reality in the world. There are different semantics for establishing the truth or false of statements. But we're not going to worry about that. The idea here is that we're saying moral statements can be true or false. The opposite of that is non-cognitivism, tripping over that word there a bit, which views moral discourse as a way to express attitudes towards certain actions. And I might broaden it and say something like this. If we have moral statements, then non-cognitivism is the attribution of other propositional attitudes to those moral statements. So sticking with the statement, killing humans is wrong, a non-cognitivist moral discourse might be, and I feel that in my bones, or the thought disgusts me. And you see how that's different from saying that the statement is true or the statement is false? And it removes us from having to appeal to some kind of semantics in order to ground our moral discourse. So the classic example, we'll refer to him again, is David Hume, who assigns moral distinctions to affect or emotional appeal. Now, I want to be clear here. When we say cognitivism, we're not really meaning cognitivism in exactly the same sense that it's meant in theories of teaching and learning. Now, I've used an example from a BC campus publication, Teaching in a Digital Age, which actually looks at the cognitive domain. And, we can think of it as, say, part of Bloom's taxonomies or whatever. And that's not exactly what's meant. But all the tools that we see in the cognitive domain, evaluation, synthesis, analysis, application, etc., along with even some of the minor concepts like data, information, facts, concepts, problems, etc., all of those apply to cognitivism. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that cognitivism is probably the dominant approach in ethical thinking today. I don't think it's a stretch at all, because cognitivism is the dominant approach to pretty much everything today. Within cognitivism, but not necessarily within cognitivism, and so the diagram back at the beginning here kind of represents it as though it belongs with cognitivism, is the idea of realism. Now, I think realism could also be a non-cognitivist perspective, but Now we're not really looking at questions of semantics, so it gets a bit tricky. But the idea of realism is that moral ideas are true or false independently of what we think. In other words, there is some fact of morality, whatever it is. So, for example, we look at a moral proposition such as, it is morally wrong to torture an innocent child for fun. A moral realist would say, this is objectively and independently true. Doesn't matter what we think about it, it is true. And off to the side of the slide here, I've got an expression of what might be called robust moral realism. So that's the idea that, there are three conditions. First of all, the moral proposition is irreducibly normative. It's not reduced to other facts about the world. If, for example, the way things are in nature or the way things are in society. The moral proposition is itself a basic fundamental truth. And it's also objective. The idea here in robust moral realism is that the truth of the proposition is independent of our existing attitudes. Whether or not we believe that it's morally wrong to torture an innocent child for fun, it is independently morally wrong to torture an innocent child for fun. And then the third thing is that it's optimistic. It actually kind of lines up with what our deepest moral beliefs are. And in fact, we could say that perhaps through moral intuition or moral apprehension, we are seeing into these deep truths directly. Much the way we know what a triangle is just by thinking what a triangle is. Or just the way we know what the properties of space and time must be just by thinking about the properties of space and time. Similarly, just by thinking of the concept of morality, we can see directly that this proposition is objectively true. That really accords with a lot of people's intuitive thinking about morality. It doesn't matter what you say, torturing children for fun is wrong. And there's nothing that could make that right. So we can come up with slightly less stringent definitions of moral realism. For example, we could require that we actually know the principle. There can't be moral principles that are objectively true out there in the world that we don't know about. Or we could say something like, these truths are true by definition as opposed to true by fact, or whatever. There are different flavors of this idea. But it is the idea that there are fundamental moral truths. This leads sometimes to an idea of moral universalism. And I've talked about this a few times in this course, and I'm going to come back to it again. And moral universalism is the idea that there is, a universal set of moral principles. Or, to be a little less precise, perhaps, a universal morality. Again, there are two ways to approach this. We could even make it three ways if we add an analytic, but really, we have descriptive moral universalism, and that is the idea that there is one universal morality shared by all cultures. Now, I personally think that that proposition is descriptively false. And here we have a diagram of some examinations of different types of cultures and some examinations of their attitude toward moral virtues. And if there was moral universalism, descriptively, then all of those bars would be the same length. And we can just see by looking at the diagram, they're not all the same length. So there are differences in morality between cultures, and some quite significant ones. You know, especially with respect to property, especially with respect to you know, deference to authority or reciprocity, etc. Descriptive or prescriptive moral universalism would say even if there isn't actually a universal morality, there should be. Now, we can base that on several grounds. We can base it on, as I said, moral realism. But we could also base it on something like a moral pragmatism. You know, life would be a lot easier if we all had the same beliefs. We see that kind of thinking expressed a lot in the technical world, right? The way to move forward is for all of us to have a shared common standard of whatever. And we see this working its way through to ethical discussions where people say, and mean it quite literally, we should have one ethical standard that applies to all instances of AI or analytics and learning. And not just one shared standard, but a shared vocabulary, a set of shared methods, a set of shared tests, etc. That's moral universalism. Against universalism is relativism. And again, there are different flavors of relativism, but you get the idea. Relativism is the idea that one way or another, there are no universal moral truths. That there are ways in which ethics and morality can vary. And the three types here are three ways where that we can think of them varying. One of them is descriptive, and I actually happen to adhere to this, that we can observe different moral norms. We can observe different systems of ethics out there in the world. And especially from a historical perspective, if we look back at what people believed, you know, 20 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, that certainly seems to be true. But also I've observed, you know, that the moral basis for ethics from one society to the next is quite different. There's also a meta-ethical relativism, and that's the idea that there are no universal or extra-cultural moral truths. So it kind of allows for a moral universality within a culture, so everybody living in the culture is governed under a universal morality, but it doesn't extend beyond it. And then normative relativism is the practical application of relativism in the world, and essentially it's the affirmation of the expression live and let live, right? We have different moral principles, and nothing is going to be gained by going and having a fight over them. You follow your ethics, I'll follow mine. That's a view that bothers a lot of people. And I find that interesting. It's an interesting characteristic of ethics. People, and I don't really have a slide for this, but you know, we can think of ethics as something inherently personal as a way of guiding our own life. But people very rarely stop there. And they believe that whatever their principle of ethics is, it's something that should apply to the community around them. And then the size of that community can vary from, you know, a set of ethics held within a family, to a set of ethics held within a village or a town, to a set of ethics held within a country or a religion or a culture, to maybe even a global set of ethics. So people resist the idea of live and let live and find that a violation of their own personal ethics is a good reason to take action, whether advocacy or force, on someone else. And that often returns us back to the principle of, ethics according to whoever is the most powerful. Now, as soon as you begin to apply your ethics to other people in anything more than just a, you know, I really think you should kind of way, then we've moved ethics from one domain to a different domain. We've moved it, for example, from the domain of rationality to the domain of politics, and sometimes even to the domain of geopolitics. And that's something we need to be aware of. It's one thing to be justified in our own morality. It's quite another to be justified in extending that morality to other people. And that's one of the bases behind relativism. The idea that there is, in fact, no ground for asserting, either descriptively or normatively, that other people should follow the same ethic that you do. In fact, we can take it even further, and people have, and actually talk about moral skepticism. And moral skepticism, it's more of an epistemological position, that is, it's more based in the philosophy of knowledge than it is an ethical position, but ultimately it's the assertion that we cannot know about morality one way or another. So, again, you know, it's philosophy, so we're going to break down into a whole bunch of categories, right? So, we could actually make it an epistemological argument. We could actually argue that there is no moral knowledge. We can't acquire it. There are no justified moral beliefs. We may think we can justify moral beliefs, but if we apply the skeptical argument to them, imagining, for example, that the opposite of our belief is true and finding there's no contradiction, we can't justify our moral beliefs. Similarly, we could be dogmatically skeptical and simply assert that, you know, we can't be certain about moral knowledge or justified moral beliefs. We can even go beyond that and talk about the aptness or the relevance of moral discourse, whether it is even makes sense to apply moral judgment in cases. I'll give you an example. At least this is just my interpretation of moral aptness, right? But, you know, I have a badge here. I could drop it or I could continue to hold it. In fact, I dropped it. So, was that right or wrong? Well, it doesn't even make sense to ask the question, does it? And similarly, in a lot of our actions, and maybe all of our actions, it doesn't really make sense to ask the question, was it right or was it wrong? We can ask about other things, like, say, should we punish that act? And clearly no, right? I mean, I don't think it was a punishable offense to drop my badge. It might be a punishable offense for me to give my badge to a Russian agent, but it's a different story. So even if there's moral reality, you know, it just doesn't enter into our judgments about the aptness of moral statements, and so on, right? There are many ways we can be skeptical about ethics and morality. There are many ways, and in fact, probably an infinite number of ways, we can undermine our knowledge of the truth of a particular moral statement. You know, it's hard enough to be sure about a simple truth like, here is a pen. And there are long involved arguments to the effect that I cannot know that here is a pen is true. And that's with respect to a pen that I can actually see and hold and you know, open and well, I guess it's not really a pen, but and write things with, etc. And moral truths are a lot more ethereal than pens. And, you know, it's not like we can hold one in our hands very easily. So there are really good grounds for moral skepticism. And even more to the point, the way ethics is often set up, and indeed even the way it's been set up in this course, and I did that a little bit deliberately because it just is the standard way ethics is presented, it's some sort of moral choice. And you all, I was going to use this, but you all know the picture, right, of the person with the good and the evil on their shoulder, and they have to choose between one of them. And it's always presented, ethics is always presented to us in the form of making some kind of decision, making the right choice, picking the morally good action, even developing the morally good virtue, or signing a morally valuable contract. But we could ask whether we even make moral decisions, whether we can, whether it's practical, whether morality even and ethics even present themselves as the sort of things where we make choices. I don't know why we got this buffet model of ethics. It's almost like the buffet model of educational theory, right? And we sit back and we say, well, I'll pick this theory, right? And, you know, and first-year philosophy students are famous for that, right? They'll take their ethical course, and at the end of the ethical course, they'll write a paper, and they'll say, out of all the possibilities, I will choose utilitarianism because... And having made that choice, now they're committed for the rest of their life because of the fallacy of sunk cost. They'll forever be defending the decision about what ethical theory to follow when they made when they were 18. But it's not so simple as that. A lot of these choices are imposed on us. A lot of these choices are Hobson's choice. There are no good right answers. A lot of these choices are choices we may think we're making, but we've actually somehow been influenced into making. You know, we often participate in a practice of what can be called moral rationalization. And here's a little study that I found in one of the PLOS journals, where what they did is they took a bunch of moral statements and then they revised them so that the statement expressed the opposite of what it said. And what happened was when they actually applied these statements to people and asked them to, you know, indicate whether they agreed with or disagreed with the statement, they found that people were agreeing with something that was the exact opposite of something that they agreed to not 20 minutes ago. And in the discussions of these choices, they would offer elaborate arguments in favor of the choices that they had made, even though these arguments, again, were contradictory to each other. So the wording of these moral choices, the way these things are presented to you, can influence whether or not you believe you support them. And I think, you know, I mean, that's, surveyors know that that's true in general, but it's also true in ethics. And it's especially true in ethics when we start analyzing the meanings of moral words themselves, right? Are you for freedom, or are you against utter anarchy? You know, I mean, we can use different words to express different positions, or use different words to express the same position where you support it in one instance and oppose it in another. Well-known phenomena. That doesn't mean people are utterly clueless about ethics and morality. In fact, I don't think that's true at all. I think even young children know about ethics and morality. Just ask any child if something was fair, and they'll tell you. But I think that the idea of presenting ethics as choices, putting it into words or principles, and then saying, pick one, leads us to really bad understandings of what ethics actually are and what people actually believe about ethics. Which kind of takes us over to the non-cognitivist approach to ethics and morality. Now, as I said earlier, non-cognitivism expresses or describes attitudes to moral statements. Now, and again, these could be descriptive attitudes, right? People find rotting flesh disgusting. Or they could be normative attitudes. People should find rotting flesh disgusting. And they break down, non-cognitivist approaches break down into several categories, three of which are emotivism. They're just expressing a moral judgment. It's wrong. They're not saying that the statement, eating cats is wrong, is true or false. They're just saying eating cats is wrong. Nothing more than that. Or it could be prescriptivism. You shouldn't eat cats. Right? I'm not saying it's right or wrong, or I'm not saying that it's true or false that eating cats is wrong. I'm just saying you shouldn't do it. You see the distinction there, right? Or it could be expressive. I find the idea of eating cats distasteful. So here, instead of expressing a semantical value, true or false, I'm expressing a feeling or a sentiment, such as a feeling of disgust. So these are non-cognitivist approaches to morality. And what's important here is that they aren't the sort of things that respond well to arguments, right? How are you going to argue about non-cognitivism? You feel it's disgusting. Well, and what that does is, to a significant degree, it makes moral and ethical judgments subjective. And I think a lot of people believe this at the same time they believe moral universalism. So go figure. And what we mean here is that ethical truth, whatever it is, depends on a perspective or point of view. Now, there are many different ways of describing perspective or point of view. It doesn't just mean from the point of view of I, the subject. Right? It could be that. It could be individually subjective. And that's the kind of subjectivism we normally think of in North America. But it could also be culturally subjective. So a culture might not have an opinion about whether something is right or wrong, properly so-called. Certainly not something argued about. But in that culture, it's wrong. And we can all think of specific ethical values in different cultures that seem to be culturally subjective. Killing cows in India, for example, is wrong, typically taken to be wrong, right? That's an ethically or a culturally subjectivist principle of morality. Here in North America, it's big business. See the difference. We can also have subjectivism in the form of an ideal observer. Now, that's what Rawls did when he came up with his theory of justice, and in particular, the original position that we described in the previous video. Instead of actually taking real existing subjects, we take an idealized version of a subject and say, well, from their point of view, what would it be? And a lot of ethical theorizing works that way. Pretty much any thought experiment will work that way. Philippa Foote's famous trolley problem kind of puts us in a position of an ideal observer. What would an ideal observer do if a trolley was coming along and by pulling the pulley, they could save one person, but they could kill, try that again. By pulling the pulley, they could kill one person, but in so doing save five, or by not pulling the pulley, they condemn five people to die, but the one person they would have killed stays alive. Now, that's an ideal observer theory, almost by definition, because it's a counterfactual. Nobody faces that particular problem. But it's subject to some of the weaknesses of the ideal observer theory, and that is, how do you know what the ideal observer would do? And, you know, a lot of people accuse Rawls of this. He sets up these ideal observers who just happen to believe the same ethical theory he happens to believe in. How handy is that? And then finally, the subject in question could be God. Or gods, depending on your religion. Or even, you know, the way, you know, the reality behind reality, as in the Taoist principles. Something like a divine command theory. And it raises a question, certainly for religious people, is something moral because God decided that it is, or because it independently is? And the hypothetical question is, if there were no God, would it still be wrong to kill another person? And if you don't like that phrasing, put it this way. Do you refrain from killing people only because God says it's wrong? And that feels like, you know, a kind of a not very good foundation for a morality. The whole concept of you do it because God told you to do it, and if you don't do what God tells you to do, you're going to go to hell. It sounds like, you know, a religious version of egoism. And, you know, you ask people about egoism, they'll say, oh no, it's very wrong, it's very subjective. And yet, divine command theory is subjective indeed in exactly the same way. So there are some interesting problems here that can be posed from the perspective of subjectivism. We come back to Hume, and the basis for a lot of our responses to these questions, and Hume takes an explicitly anti-rationalist approach to ethics. That is to say, an approach that is not based on argument and reason and truth and falsity. And there are a couple of principles here, and I've pulled out, Hume has a complex argument, out of which I've pulled a couple of principles. One of them is that reason alone cannot persuade us to act. Hume writes, famously, reason is, and ought only to be, the slave of the passions. So we have both a descriptive and normative force in that sentence. And, you know, descriptively, I think there's a lot to be said for it. You can provide a completely 100% airtight argument that something is wrong, and people will go do it anyways, because they feel like it. And that's what Hume has observed. And he's also observed that, again, people have a sense of right and wrong, even though they have not reasoned about it or thought about it. Now, this doesn't necessarily apply to animals, although, you know, we could argue about that. But it does seem to apply to children, as I pointed out, who have this sense of fairness. They haven't actually sat down and worked out the reasons for it, but they're certainly making these ethical judgments. And then Hume's second argument is, truth is disputable, not taste. What exists in the nature of things is the standard of our judgment. What each man feels within himself is the standard of sentiment. So, if we're going to make statements about cause and effect and natural laws and, you know, what exists and what doesn't, then we look out into the world. But that doesn't tell us about morality. The way we feel, the way we respond, perhaps the way our mirror neurons flare up, or our empathy kicks in, or our revulsion kicks in, that is the standard of ethics and morality, the standard of sentiment. And Hume argues that we actually do have this sentiment or sense of morality. Just like we have a sense of sight or a sense of balance, we have a sense of rightness or wrongness. And, you know, it's no more reliable or no less reliable than any of our other senses, but it's that sense that is what is the basis for our morality, our ethics, and it is that sense plus the combination of what we know to be true out there in the world that provides us with the reason to act or to not act. And I think there's a lot of sense to be made out of that, and certainly a good part of the rest of this course is going to be devoted to drawing out many of the implications of that idea. When we think about moral sentiment, we can think about investigating moral sentiment and investigating not just what these sentiments are, but how they change. And not just the sentiments of one person, like myself or yourself, but of people in general. And I've got a link to a paper here that does this, and basically does text-based analyses to examine changes of moral sentiment in the public. Because, you know, it's not a constant thing, and why would we expect that it is? So we can make queries of the text, we can find positive sentiments or negative sentiments being expressed in the text, and then from that we can find specific statements about things like care, fairness, purity, or harm, cheating, and degradation, etc. Now, how closely these words correspond to the actual human feeling that is sentiment is hard to say, right? There's the question of the accuracy or the reliability of sentiment detection. But remember, all the way back to Module 1, we can do sentiment detection with AI. So the question is, can we get at what human sentiments are through some kind of process using AI or using some sort of analysis? And I think that's an important question. I think certainly people will say that it can be done, and my evidence for that is here is a case where someone has said it can be done. And I think the argument can be made that sentiment is the basis for morality, and therefore what we find as actual sentiments are the basis for actual statements of morality out there in the world. But it's not so simple as that. And I'm going to throw in my last slide, the final twist in our story. And that is, who owns this? And by who owns this, I don't mean it in an economic sense, although, you know, there's certainly a sense of this being data, sentiment data being data that can be commodified and monetized. But I mean something a bit deeper than that. Who gets to say what someone's sentiment is? Now, we would think that in the first instance, each person gets to say what their own sentiment is. But we already know that not everybody has the same capacity to make a statement. We already know that the statements that individuals make need to be interpreted in some way. And we already know that the statements people make can actually be influenced by the questions that they're asked, or the problems that they're posed, or just the context in which they find themselves. And we've seen over the years different ways of, if you will, mining the sentiments of people and converting them into something like an ethics. We'll call it ethics mining. I don't know if anyone's created that before, but it works for here. So we've seen this explicitly in the philosophy of science, where there are certain scientific virtues, like simplicity and parsimony, right? Well, there's no reason why, say, simplicity is a reason to choose one scientific principle over another. Because the fact that a principle is simple in no way bears upon the fact of whether or not it's true. The world just might be really complicated. But scientists prefer simple principles, so much so that simplicity is a virtue when it comes to selecting scientific explanations. We really love things like E equals MC squared, but things that take 4, 5, 10 pages to write, not so much. There are other properties of models, and we won't get into the details here. There are properties of models and properties or ways in which we create models that have basically given us an ethics of science. And indeed, when I sit on research ethics boards, I'm not thinking just about the moral principles of a scientific inquiry. I'm also asking whether the inquiry follows the scientific virtues, whether it's a useful inquiry, whether it's asking a real question, whether its standards of evidence are of a certain quality, etc. All of these play into the ethics of science and have pretty much come to define the ethics of science. Similarly, in business ethics. Business ethics isn't concerned about ethics. Business ethics is concerned about, quote, real concerns and real-world problems of the vast majority of managers. Puts them right into that context, puts them into an environment where making money is required by law. Which, as odd as that sounds, actually is the case. It's called fiduciary duty. You've heard me mention it a few times, and that is the you know, if you have shareholders, you have a responsibility to your shareholders to maximize their return. You can't just turn around and give away the assets of your company. And so business ethics is looked at in that context. And again, we have this idea of business ethics feeding back into the concept of ethics generally. And in fact, that's what's been happening with a lot of these ethical codes. We talk about AI, we talk about ethics, and we look at the different issues, and then the way they're addressed is to go through a process of creating an ethical code, much like scientific ethics, much like business ethics, and then that ethics will define ethics and make it universal. It doesn't matter whether it's real, it's just it applies. And we're seeing this in Silicon Valley as well. And Metcalf, Moss, and Boyd have talked about this, talked about owning ethics and corporate logic and the institutionalization of ethics, writing about broader and longer standing industry commitments to meritocracy, technological solutionism, and market fundamentalism. Now, we can take each of these three things, meritocracy, solutionism, and market fundamentalism, and go back and identify the different places in the different ethical theories that they've been drawn from. There's no method to the way they've been drawn, right? Meritocracy is just sort of picked out of virtue ethics. Market fundamentalism is just picked out of social contract theory. And technological solutionism, I think, probably has its origins in utilitarianism. There's no requirement of consistency or cohesiveness. A lot of it is just whatever works for Silicon Valley, that's the ethics that we'll use. Whatever justifies the work that we're doing in Silicon Valley, that's the work that we'll do. And that's why I worry a lot about discussions of analytics, AI, and ethics being addressed by people who work in the field of AI and analytics. It becomes very circular. And you sometimes think there is only one ethic, and it's a universal ethic, and everybody believes in it, and it's something like, oh, I don't know, equity, fairness, non-biasness, etc. But that's one particular perspective, and it's an owned perspective in that it doesn't reflect in any real sense the ethics of the broader population. And in fact, there has been no real effort to integrate the ethics of the broader population into this calculation. And so, I mean, as Carl Sagan famously asked at the end of Cosmos, who speaks for Earth? Who speaks for us? Who actually owns the definition or definitions of ethics? And that takes us back to might makes right, and whoever has the most gold makes the rules. And that's what's actually happening in the field of the ethics of AI and analytics. They actually are being defined by the people who have the money to pose the question and to hire the people to offer an answer. And mostly the people that they're hiring to offer an answer are the people who think like they do. And so we have a problem here, I think. We have a problem in the sense that we haven't dealt with the grounding or the basis for the ethics that are currently being adopted in analytics and AI. And we're sort of falling into this point of view, the scientific slash business slash Silicon Valley point of view about what counts as ethically good without really asking, how do they know this? What is their justification for this? Beyond the answer that, well, they have the power and they have the money to make it so. So that's my discussion of metaethics. I have a little bit more to say about ethics before we move on to the next module in a video I'll call The End of Ethics. But I hope you enjoyed this discussion of metaethics, and I'll see you next time. I'm Stephen Downs.